In this special edition of Free Speech Radio News for Monday, September 5, 2005, John Roberts accepts the nomination for the position of Chief Justice after William H. Rehnquist passed away this weekend.
I am honored and humbled by the confidence that the President has shown in me, and I'm very much aware that if I am confirmed, I would succeed a man I deeply respect and admire.
And we go to our correspondents and to hurricane survivors in New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and Houston for the latest on the aftermath of Katrina.
I was one of the ones who lived a life of misery in a Superdome.
Welcome to this FSRN special on the Supreme Court and Hurricane Katrina. I'm Aura Bogado. Today, President Bush elevated the Supreme Court Justice nomination of John Roberts to Chief Justice in replacing William Rehnquist, who died on Saturday night. Rehnquist, who was battling thyroid cancer for the past 9 months, served on the bench for 33 years. John Roberts, who once clerked for Justice Rehnquist, has a career history that is strikingly similar to Rehnquist's. Both were relatively young conservatives who previously served in Republican administrations when nominated to the bench. Both also became connected to controversial memos they wrote concerning policy and race relations in the country. Mitch Jeserich reports from the Capitol.
To fill the vacancy that the death of Chief Justice William Rehnquist has created, this morning at the White House, President Bush announced that he is elevating the nomination of John Roberts to head the Supreme Court.
25 years ago, John Roberts came to Washington as a clerk to Justice William Rehnquist. In his boss, the young law clerk found a role model, a professional mentor, and a friend for life. I'm certain that Chief Justice Rehnquist is hoping to welcome John Roberts as a colleague. We're all sorry that day didn't come.
As the Senate Judiciary Committee was already preparing for Roberts' hearing, which has been postponed, Bush called on the Senate to confirm Roberts before the next Supreme Court session begins in October.
I'm confident that the Senate can complete hearings and confirm him as Chief Justice within a month. As a result of my decision to nominate Judge Roberts to be Chief Justice, I also have the responsibility to submit a new nominee to follow Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. I will do so in a timely manner.
Standing side by side with the President, John Roberts accepted the nomination.
I am honored and humbled by the confidence that the President has shown in me, and I'm very much aware that if I am confirmed, I would succeed a man I deeply respect and admire, a man who has been very kind to me for 25 years. Thank you, Mr. President, for that special opportunity. Thank you.
Chief Justice William Rehnquist died late Saturday night after battling thyroid cancer for 9 months. Rehnquist was nominated by President Richard Nixon in 1971, and his death signifies the end of the Nixon era in the Supreme Court. Rehnquist served for 33 years, making him the third longest justice to serve. Rehnquist was well-liked by the other eight justices, who considered him a fair broker as Chief Justice. His potential successor, John Roberts, and he have remarkable parallels in their careers. Rehnquist was once an active operative in the Republican Party who was considered a young, stout conservative when he was nominated at the age of 47. He also wrote a controversial memo in 1952 when he clerked for former Justice Robert Jackson in opposition to Brown v. Board of Education, saying that the Supreme Court correctly ruled in 1896 the Plessy v. Ferguson case that upheld separate but equal segregation. As a Republican operative in the 1960s, he was accused of intimidating voters in minority districts. At his confirmation hearing for Chief Justice in 1986, former senator from Arizona, Dennis DeConcini, questioned him about it.
Were you involved in any way to discourage minority voters in 1962 or 64?
Only in this very possible way, which I think would not be a correct answer to your question, but if you say that you were discouraging minority voters by putting a challenger in at precincts which were heavily Democratic and which certainly had a number of minority voters voting at them in order to lawfully take advantage of the state law, which permitted observing the election board functioning and challenging as provided by law, one could say, I suppose, that that did discourage minority voters, but not lawful minority voters. So if you would just amend your question to say lawful voting by minorities, I could answer unqualifiedly yes.
John Roberts is also considered a stout conservative who was active in the Reagan administration in opposition to affirmative action in school busing to combat racial segregation. In 1982, Roberts argued against the expansion of the Voting Rights Act that was overwhelmingly approved by Congress. Still, a compromise was struck with the White House and the measure passed. Longtime civil rights lawyer John Britton explains what the expansion has meant for minorities.
Passage of the Voting Rights Act in 65, and particularly the 1982 amendment, has led to the greatest increase of minority voters of any other civil rights statute. Today, in the United States Congress, African-American congresspersons are roughly 10% of the Congress. So the Voting Rights Act, perhaps, is the most successful of the civil rights acts of the 1960s. And particularly the 1982 amendment that Roberts opposed created the opportunity to challenge more unconstitutional legal voting districts and lead to more minority elected officials at the federal, state, county, and local levels in government.
In the last 2 weeks, numerous organizations have announced their opposition to Roberts, including the National Organization of Women, the NAACP, the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and ADA Watch. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
D.C. Editor Mitch Jezerich is on the line from D.C. Mitch, can you give us an update on how these changes will affect the hearings for Roberts?
Yes, tomorrow the hearings were supposed to take place for John Roberts' confirmation as a justice on the Supreme Court. What's going to happen now is that hearing has been postponed until at least after the funeral of William Rehnquist, and the schedule for Rehnquist, what's going to happen there is tomorrow, as well as on Wednesday, his body is going to lie in wake in the Supreme Court building. And then towards the end of Wednesday, he's going to be buried in the Arlington National Cemetery. And so the hearing has been postponed at least until Thursday. However, official announcement has not been made yet. The word we're getting right now is that it'll either be as early as this Thursday or as late as next Monday, and that announcement will actually be made tomorrow. And of course, instead of having just a confirmation hearing for John Roberts to be just a regular justice on the bench, the hearing's going to become not just a justice but also a chief justice.
And what does that mean to pick someone new for the position of Chief Justice?
Well, you know, it's actually it's not unprecedented. 11 of the 16 previous Chief Justices were actually new to the court. The fact that Rehnquist was actually elevated after being picked by Richard Nixon, but had Ronald Reagan elevate him to the Chief Justice, is more of an anomaly than having somebody new come in. And so if he's confirmed, then he'll be the 12th out of the 17 justices to be newly appointed to the court as well. And really what's going on there is it's the president's opportunity to put John Roberts, who's still quite relatively young at 50 years of age, to have him lead the Supreme Court potentially for the next 25 to 30 years. Now George Bush gets to have his nominee do that.
A week after Hurricane Katrina devastated the nation's Gulf Coast, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin is estimating that as many as 10,000 people may have died as a result of the storm. At the same time, the city has begun its cleanup effort, including evacuating potentially thousands of residents who remain in their homes. As FSRN's David Enders found, many of the residents are refusing to be evacuated, fearing an uncertain future.
Much of the city is still flooded, and today was actually the first day I was sort of in downtown New Orleans. And what we found was that, you know, there's still search and rescue operations going on. They're still pulling people out with helicopters and on boats. But we spoke to a lot of people who have, you know, no food. You know, they're getting water from local distributors. They don't have electricity. They don't have gas. They don't have running water. But they want to remain in their homes either to stay with their pets or because they don't want to leave their homes, or they literally don't know what's going to happen to them if they're evacuated.
And Mayor Nagin says that the body count may be as high as 10,000. Have you seen corpses there?
Yeah, we have seen corpses. Many of them apparently have been here for most of the week. the suspicion is that a lot of people are still trapped in houses. Based on the anecdotal reports, those numbers certainly seem possible, but I don't think anyone will really know until the water starts to recede considerably. Much of the city is still under, 5 feet or more of water.
And for those people that are refusing to leave, how are they getting food, water, medicine?
The ones we spoke to, they're not getting medicine. One woman who didn't want to leave her dogs was also figuring she would have to leave anyway because they were on her husband's last tube of insulin. And the woman living next to her was not getting medication for her mental illness, which was readily evident. And they said that the food they had gotten in the last week and the water they had gotten in the last week had been dropped off by a local man. And local efforts in some ways are being stymied. We've been talking to people on the west bank of the river who said they've been trying to set up relief programs because they do have, in a lot of those places, water and gas, still no electricity. And they've been told by the government not to do those because they might start a riot.
That was David Enders outside the New Orleans Convention Center. While most of New Orleans remains flooded, some neighborhoods remain in the clear. Malik Rahim is in one of those neighborhoods, Algiers. Malik, what, if anything, has changed today in terms of relief efforts?
Well, I'd say the major change that I saw today is no longer the National Guard and the Coast Guard aiming guns at, holding guns and threatening position when you go over to talk with them. And that has been a major improvement. You no longer see white vigilantes riding around, so those two have been the major improvements. You know, we still don't have any ice, water, or food being distributed in Algiers. We have to go into Jefferson Parish all the way to West Wego, which is about 17 miles away, to get ice, water, and food. And that's about a two-hour trip each way. You know, when you look at that, you're going to be in line for about an hour and a half. So now we are starting to work it out where, we know we have to do this three times a day to basically cover the neighborhood. So you have about maybe seven groups, with trucks and cars that is making that trip. So we're starting to see the major improvements that most people have ice. And here in Louisiana, in this sun, as humid as it is, ice is so precious to life. But we still have dead bodies in the streets. And there's no reason for us to have dead bodies in Algiers, because they're not flooded. We are not flooded, but we have dead bodies that continue to just lay there. We have some that have been here. We have a man over here that's been dead since last Monday. So for one whole week, his body done laid there until now. It's bloated and infested with maggots. We have a lady body right across by the Jackson Street Ferry that has been laying there since Wednesday. So, and then you have others. I would say they have a total of about 18 to 20 dead bodies in Algiers. And it wouldn't be taking nothing for to get them up and out the way. It's just so sad when you see children looking at these dead bodies and coming back with them blank stares of seeing what happened to a corpse when it's out in 95 degree heat and 95 degree humidity.
Malik, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Malik Rahim is in the neighborhood of Algiers in New Orleans. We now go north of New Orleans to Baton Rouge, where correspondent Leanne Caldwell is standing by. Leanne, please tell us, what's the situation like for evacuees there?
Well, I'm at the River Center Complex. It has become a evacuation site with survivors, evacuees who are staying here. It's the largest shelter in Baton Rouge. It's holding nearly 6,000 people. Many of these people being housed here were early evacuees. They got out before the storm hit. They went on first orders. But they are only a small portion of the people who are who have been mislocated from their homes. There's an estimated 350,000 people who have been relocated here, nearly doubling the population of Baton Rouge to 700,000 people. Inside, there is some security. People have to walk through a metal detector. There's cots lined up. People have made their own little area. Families have grouped together, people that they know. There's portions of the evacuation center there's a basketball hoop. There's games set aside to keep the children occupied. But one major concern is that FEMA has yet to come here. Their headquarters for Louisiana are supposed to be in Baton Rouge, and FEMA is nowhere to be seen. I spoke with FEMA just an hour ago, and they have not yet set up headquarters. They're still trying to do it. They say the logistics are a mess. They haven't gotten it together. So many of these people are here. They've already applied for unemployment since they lost their jobs. Unemployment checks are supposed to be coming out this week, but still they're waiting for FEMA, and there's nothing in sight as far as that is concerned.
And Baton Rouge's population has doubled as a result of these evacuees. We understand that there's a lot of problems with trying to get them accommodated. How are people dealing with everyday issues like traffic and so forth?
Well, traffic, I mean, from what I've heard, the residents say that they are very welcoming. I've stayed mostly around the evacuees today, so as far as the residents are concerned, the people that I have spoken to, I've spoken to a lot more evacuees, but they say we are here to help these people. As far as throughout the entire city, where neighborhoods have become more crowded, where there's 20 to 25 people living in a house. I spoke with a woman who is staying with her brother. They have over 20 people living in their house, and they are sharing one phone line. They're trying to get through to FEMA, where they've heard no response. They're trying to look for jobs. They're just trying to, the evacuees are trying to resettle their lives because they know that they're not going to be going back anytime soon.
Thank you, Leanne, for that report. You're listening to a special broadcast of Free Speech Radio News with live reports from Louisiana, Houston, and Washington, D.C. Check out our website at www.fsrn.org. The way I keep going up for your line. Criticism continues to grow towards the federal government's slow response before and after the hurricane, as the Bush administration faces the largest national emergency since 9/11. Questioned about inadequate relief efforts, Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said now is the wrong time to answer those questions.
We are in the middle of an emergency now. It is not over. It is not time to draw a deep breath and start to go back and revisit. There'll be plenty of time to go back and do lessons learned. From this point on, I only have one thing I want to think about, which is making sure that we are doing everything possible as quickly as possible to prevent further misfortune and loss of life and distress. And I'm not going to take 1 minute away from doing that to answer questions about things which we'll have plenty of time to revisit later. The focus from this point on is going to be simply on what are we doing now, how do we keep doing it, how do we do it better if we have to, and how do we get it done.
Meanwhile, the National Guard and what's left of local police forces are attempting to secure the city. While Chertoff assures that New Orleans is now under control, it remains impossible to estimate how long the recovery effort will take. Admiral Timothy Keating is the commander of U.S. Northern Command. He says the National Guard will remain in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi for months rather than weeks.
We are already working very hard on, what will be the end state. The damage that I saw firsthand yesterday recommends to me that we will be there for a while. The flooding, the floodwaters are receding, I believe, ever so slowly in New Orleans. So that problem, the challenges will shift a little bit. As the waters go down, folks are going to want to get back in their homes and get power restored. A lot of the homes in Louisiana are made of wood, and so as the wood dries, we have another challenge. All of us in disaster response for ensuring that we don't have fires of any magnitude, and we're working on that.
Aside from beginning to secure infrastructure and utilities, thousands of people remain without essential medicine to treat chronic diseases, and many need medical assistance and many need medical assistance from injuries resulting from the hurricane. Dr. Renee Morrissey is a physician with Charity Hospital. Evacuated by boat, he was the last doctor to leave the New Orleans facility late Friday night. Morrissey traveled to Baton Rouge and later to Houma in southern Louisiana, where patients were being dumped at that charity hospital that was not assigned additional personnel. Morrissey expressed deep disappointment at FEMA's insufficient efforts.
My opinion is it's been a travesty from the beginning, that when we were told that they were taking over, promises that were made to us about how our patients would be treated, what our role would be, and what our role would not be. Those were promises that were made to me by senior staff in Charity Hospital. I can't vouch for where they originated, but seeing the FEMA operations firsthand in Baton Rouge has been terribly disappointing. Seeing the tremendous disorganization, waste of human resources, as well as been disappointment and tragedy to hear from nurses and staff members who have seen patients who were evacuated from Charity suffer and in a couple of cases die after leaving Charity Hospital because they're arriving at collection points where there was no medical care available to them.
And finally, we go to Houston, where KPFT News Director Renee Feltz has been talking to some of the people who have evacuated hurricane-ravaged portions of the Gulf. She produced this collage of survivors.
I come out the Superdome. They left us in there. They just left us in there to die. And I was one of the ones who lived the life of misery in the Superdome. When you first got there, you got one information. We've been in there 4 or 5 days. After that, they didn't tell us anything. And they cut the water off on us. They had us. They left out the building. We fend for ourselves. Women was putting women was having their babies. They were just throwing them in the garbage can. Children was committing suicide, jumping off the Superdome because their family had lost their whole family and nothing to live for. They were shooting everything. They were stealing the cars, guns, shooting at everybody. Nobody was safe. Babies crying, screaming all day. Sick people had to suffer. It was miserable. And they had rapes in there. Everything you can imagine. I felt like I'm being a taxpayer. Why am I working hard like this and I'm a taxpayer and being treated like this? That's what we work and pay taxes for, is for things to go right and went wrong.
It's like this here. It's like, you know, this with any race of people. You know what I'm saying? If your back is put in the corner when it calls for you to survive for your family, you know what I'm saying? You liable to go to any measures for your child. You know what I'm saying? If it calls for you to break in this store for your child to eat, and you stranded, and the law enforcement is not giving you the type of help. I mean, I stood on a highway and seen 50 state troopers pass. At least they must have had about 1,000 people and just passed, and they didn't have nobody in their back seats or nothing. I seen several army trucks pass. So you mean to tell me if you're not gonna give me the help I need? Then I should by any means, I should go to any means that I need to survive. Right. You know, you putting my back against the wall, you making me go to these terms. Something that I don't want to do, but you forcing me to do in order for me to survive. I got a 2-year-old child and a 3-year-old child. You mean to tell me I'm supposed to let my seeds die? And you know you're supposed to help me, and you passing me up in the car. You got a functioning vehicle, and you not trying to help me. And also, you know what I'm saying? It's a worldwide evacuation. You won't open this store and take none of the meat and food products out there to get it this family? Well, why shouldn't they do the things that they do? You know, everybody, you know, it ain't, see, they like paint a picture about New Orleans and young black men. It ain't about that. It ain't about no color, none of that. It ain't about we head first, buck wild, or none of that. It's about survival, respect. You know what I'm saying? If they would have showed the proper respect towards the people would have showed them the proper respect. And that's all I have to say.
We are now joined on the line by KPFT News Director and FSRN Correspondent Renee Feltz. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you, Ada.
Can you tell us how many survivors of Hurricane Katrina now call Houston home and how Houstonians are responding to their new neighbors?
Well, the mayor and officials here estimate there is about 150,000 to 200,000 evacuees and survivors staying in hotels, private homes, and shelters throughout the city, including the Dome City, which is what they're calling the Astrodome now. I'm out here where some Houstonians have responded to their new neighbors with a protest telling them that they stand in solidarity with them and that they
are demanding for all of them, regardless of immigration status or income, free housing, food, clothing, medical care, jobs, and education. And they're also calling for the government to be charged with negligent homicide and abandonment. Other Houstonians are trying to catch those who may fall through the cracks. The unions are butting up with their members. The Communication Workers of America just approved $4 million out of their general fund to assist members of their union. The GLBT Community Center here is taking in HIV-positive survivors. And Micro Radio has been set up here, it's in the process of being set up, I should say, at the Astrodome to inform survivors of some of the options they have as far as assistance.
Renee, thanks for that report. The government of Venezuela announced yesterday that it would provide money, shelter, canned food, gasoline, and rescue teams to the victims of Hurricane Katrina. Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez also issued strong criticism over how the Bush administration has handled the catastrophe. Greg Wilpert reports from Caracas.
Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez, while announcing more aid to the victims of Hurricane Katrina during his weekly television talk show yesterday, reiterated his criticism of the Bush administration's handling of the crisis. Already last week, Chavez had said the U.S. government had reacted far too slowly.
Unas palabras del presidente de los Estados Unidos, quien estaba de vacaciones.
The president of the United States, who was on vacation, said some words, for 2 minutes, I think. He directed himself to the people of the United States and called for people to flee. That is the verb he used. Well, many fled. We saw it, those kilometer-long lines of cars leaving New Orleans. But those who left were the ones who had vehicles. Not one military truck was provided. How many military trucks does the United States have?
President Chavez also said that Venezuela would increase the amount of aid it had promised late last week, providing $5 million in relief aid to the victims of Hurricane Katrina. The aid will be provided via the Venezuelan state-owned oil company Citgo, which operates 5 refineries and 14,000 gas stations in the U.S. Also, Venezuela offered 2 medical units, electricity generators, water purifying units, 50 tons of canned food, and 20 tons of bottled water. The CEO of Citgo, Felix Rodriguez, called in to Chavez's TV program and explained how Citgo was also providing shelter to Katrina evacuees.
With the volunteers from Citgo, we're helping, along with the mayor's office and the Red Cross, the refugees that are in Lake Charles, about 2,500 people. We are also opening a shelter in Corpus Christi.
In addition to the financial and material support and the shelter for evacuees, Venezuela also said it is sending a tanker with 1 million barrels of gasoline to help alleviate the energy crisis in the region, where numerous refineries had to shut down due to the hurricane. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
Trouble in mind, I'm blue.
This special edition of Free Speech Radio News was produced by Monica Lopez, Aura Bogado, and Renee Feltz. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Technical production and engineering by Eric Klein in Berkeley and Molly White in Los Angeles. Special thanks to Deepa Fernandez, Dolores Bernal, and Christian Roseland. For FSRN in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.
Trouble in mind, that's true. I'm gonna lay my